You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Free Radicals by James Pogue. Yarvin considers himself a reactionary, not just a conservative. He thinks it is impossible for an Ivy League educated person to really be a conservative. He has consistently argued that conservatives waste their time and political energy on fights over issues like gay marriage or critical race theory, because liberal ideology holds sway in the important institutions of prestige media and academia, an intertwined nexus he calls the cathedral. He developed a theory to explain the fact that America has lost its so-called state capacity, his explanation for why it so often seems that it is not actually capable of governing anymore. The power of the executive branch has slowly devolved to an oligarchy of the educated who care more about competing for status within the system than they do about America's national interest. No one directs this system, and hardly anyone who participates in it believes that it's a system at all. Someone like me, who has made a career of writing about militias and extremist groups, might go about my work thinking that all I do is try to tell important stories and honestly describe political upheaval. But within the cathedral, the best way for me to get big assignments and win attention is to identify and attack what seem like threats against the established order, which includes nationalist, anti-government types, or people who refuse to obey the opinions of the cathedral's experts on issues like vaccine mandates, in as alarming a way as I possibly can. This cycle becomes self-reinforcing and has been sent into hyperdrive by Twitter and Facebook, because the stuff that compels people to click on articles or share clips of a professor tends to affirm their worldview, or frighten them, or both at the same time. The more attention you gain in the cathedral system, the more you can influence opinion and government policy. Journalists and academics and thinkers of any kind now live in a desperate race for attention. And in Yarvin's view, this is all really a never-ending bid for influence, serving the interest of our oligarchical regime. So, I may think I write for a living, but to Yarvin, what I actually do is more like a weird combination of intelligence gathering and propagandizing, which is why no one I was talking to at NatCon really thought it would be possible for me to write a fair piece about them. You won't hear people use the cathedral term a lot in public. Other right-wing Twitter lit up with delight when Yarvin sketched the concept on Tucker Carlson's Fox Nation show last September. People who've opened their eyes to this system of control have taken the red pill, a term Yarvin started using back in 2007, long before it got watered down to generally mean supporting Trump. To truly be red-pilled, you have to understand the workings of the cathedral. And the way conservatives can actually win in America, he has argued, is for a Caesar-like figure to take power back from this devolved oligarchy and replace it with a monarchical regime run like a startup. As early as 2012, he proposed the acronym RAGE, Retire All Government Employees, as a shorthand for a first step in the overthrow of the American regime. What we needed, Yarvin thought, was a national CEO, or what's called a dictator. Yarvin now shies away from the word dictator and seems to be trying to promote a friendlier face of authoritarianism as the solution to our political warfare. If you're going to have a monarchy, it has to be a monarchy of everyone, he said. By the time TechCrunch publicized Yarvin's identity in 2013, he had become influential in a small circle of the disaffected elite. In 2014, The Baffler published a lengthy look at his influence, titled Mouth-Breathing Machiavelli's Dream of a Silicon Reich. The piece warned that Yarvin's ideas were spreading among prominent figures like Thiel and Balaji Srinivasan, formerly the CTO of Coinbase, and that it was possible for an intellectual fringe to seize key positions of authority and power, and eventually bring large numbers of people around, just as the Koch brothers once had, with their pro-business libertarianism, a position that Thiel was quickly moving away from. In 2017, BuzzFeed News published an email exchange between Yarvin and Milo Yiannopoulos in which Yarvin said that he'd watched the 2016 election returns with Thiel. He's fully enlightened, Yarvin wrote. Just plays it very carefully. Master soon had an office in Trump Tower. He and Thiel worked, generally without success, to install figures like Srinivasan, whom they proposed to head the FDA, and who himself often talked about the paper belt in an echo of Yarvin's cathedral concept, and made common cause with figures like Steve Bannon, who wanted to pick apart the administrative state, an idea that at least had a hint of Yarvin's rage proposal. Yarvin eventually stopped working as a programmer and left the Bay Area, moving with his wife and two children to Nevada. His wife died in April 2021, and he seems to have been devastated, publishing searching poems about her. But last September, a month before we spoke, he posted a dating call, inviting women who were reasonably pretty and pretty smart, as he put it, and have read my work and like it, and who thought that the purpose of dating is to get married and have kids, to email him so they could set up a Zoom date. His writing doesn't really represent who he is, Lawrenson told me. So I answered this email, and I was just like, hi, I'm a liberal, but I have a high IQ, and I want kids, and I'm actually just really curious to talk to you. The two are now engaged. Lawrenson told me she'd had a gradual awakening that accelerated during the upheavals of the early pandemic and the protest of the summer of 2020. I started really getting down to NRX ideas, she said, using a common online abbreviation for the neo-reactionary fringe, because I was tracking the riots, by which she meant the violence that erupted amid some of the Black Lives Matter protest. I have a background in social justice, she said, but she was horrified by how the mainstream media covered the riots. It was just a violation, such a violation, of all of my values. She'd had a strange realization after she and Yarvin started dating, discovering that some of her friends had been reading him for years. I found out that all of these people had been reading NRX stuff just like me. They just never told anyone about it, she said. It has been very striking to me, she said, how cool this world is becoming. Yarvin had given people a way to articulate a notion that somehow felt subversive to say out loud in America, that history was headed in the wrong direction. Somebody said something earlier that captured it for me, Lawrenson said, just before they had to leave to go to a slightly hush-hush private dinner with Vance and a few others. They said, "You can be here and know you're not alone." People at the conference seemed excited about being in a place where they weren't alone. I skipped most of the talks, which ranged from sessions about confronting the threat of China to the liberal influence on pop culture to worker power. Hawley gave a keynote on the assault on the masculine virtues, and Cruz offered up a traditional stump speech evoking Reagan, and saying he thought conservatives would soon prevail at the ballot box. I'm pretty sure a lot of the 20-somethings rolled their eyes at that, Yarvin said to me afterward with a smirk. The 20-somethings had a bigger vision. Up by the bar every night, hordes of young men, mostly, would descend to drink and bear hug and spot favorite podcasters and writers. You could see Dave Rubin and Jack Murphy, who host a popular New Rightish YouTube channel and is trying to build a fraternal group of men who believe in positive masculinity that he calls the Liminal Order. Pretty much everyone had the same trimmed beard and haircut, sides buzzed short, the top longer, and combed with a bit of gel to one side. I didn't see a single black person under the age of 50, though there were attendees of South Asian and Middle Eastern descent. In March, the journalist Jeff Charlotte, a Vanity Fair contributing editor who covers the American right, tweeted that the intellectual New Right is a white supremacist project designed to cultivate non-white support, and he linked it to resurgent nationalist and authoritarian politics around the world. It's part of a global fascist movement, not limited to the anti-blackness of the U.S. and Europe. Yet many on the New Right seem increasingly unfazed by accusations that they're white nationalist or racist. Masters, in particular, seems willing to go to commentators, believing that the ensuing arguments will redound to his political advantage. "Good luck hitting me with that," Masters told the podcaster Alex Kashuta recently, arguing that accusations of racism had become a political bludgeon used to keep conservative ideas outside the political mainstream. "Good luck criticizing me for saying critical race theory is anti-white." But for all the chatter of looming dystopia, no one I spoke to raised one of the most dystopian aspects of American life, our vast apparatus of prisons and policing. Most people seemed more caught up in fighting what they perceived as the cant and groupthink among other members of the political media class, or the hypocrisy of rich white liberals who put up Black Lives Matter signs in front of multimillion dollar homes, than they were with the raw experience that has given shape to America's current racial politics. Milius was a sardonic and constant presence, easy to find smoking as Yarvin stood and talked at warp speed in his unmistakable voice. She was by far the most strikingly dressed person there, favoring Gucci and Ralph Lauren and lots of gold jewelry and big sunglasses. She is the daughter of the conservative director John Milius, who co-wrote Apocalypse Now and directed Red Dawn. She grew up in Los Angeles, and it turned out that we'd both gone to the same tiny liberal arts college in Manhattan. So, like pretty much all the people there, she was used to living in social spaces where conservative views were considered strange, if not downright evil. She thought something had radically changed since 2015, after she went to film school at USC and started working in Hollywood, before she suddenly dropped everything to work for Trump's campaign in Nevada, eventually landing a job in his State Department. "What this is," she said, "is a new thought movement. So it's very hard to put your finger on and articulate what it is outside of Trumpism, because it really is separate from the man himself. It has nothing to do with that." She argued that the New Right, or whatever you wanted to call it, was paradoxically much less authoritarian than the ideology that now presented itself as mainstream. "I get the feeling, and I could be wrong," she said, "that the right, actually at this point, is like almost in this live-and-let-live place where the left used to be at." What she meant specifically, the idea that you can't raise your kids in a traditional, somewhat religious household without having them educated at school that their parents are Nazis. This apparent laissez-faire obscures somewhat the intense focus that some people in this world have on trans issues, or what they might say is the media's intense focus on trans issues, one of a suite of mimetic viruses, as Kashuta, the podcaster, put it, that spread a highly individualistic, liberal culture that is destructive to traditional ways of life. But the laissez-faire has helped win unlikely converts. Milius brought up Red Scare, a podcast that has become the premier example of this attraction. She actually cast one of the hosts, Dasha Nekrasova, in the film she made as her senior thesis in directing school at USC. The Red Scare host both started out as diffident socialists, back when it was still possible to think that socialism represented an edgy political stance in the little interlocking spheres of America's media and political set. One of them, Nekrasova, actually became known in media circles for a clip that went mega viral in 2018, when she cut dead a reporter for Alex Jones's InfoWars, trying to ambush Bernie Sanders supporters at a festival in Austin. "I just want people to have health care, honey," she deadpanned. "You people have, like, worms in your brains, honestly." Fast forward to November 2021, and Nekrasova and her co-host, Anna Kuchian, were posting photos of themselves with Jones's arms wrapped around them under an evening Texas sun. Nekrasova now has a role on HBO Succession, playing a PR rep working with Kendall Roy. The show itself set right-wing Twitter, a sphere heavily populated by 20-somethings who work in tech or politics and seem to disproportionately live in D.C. and Miami, alight with delight when an episode in the latest season included a litany of key new right phrases, such as integralist and Medicare for all, abortions for none. The Red Scare host are only the best-known representatives of a fashionable dissident-y subculture centered in but not exclusive to downtown Manhattan. "Everyone dresses like a duck hunter now," a bewildered friend of mine texted recently. "People use the derisive term bug man to describe liberal men who lack tangible life skills, like fixing trucks or growing food. Guys who could end up spending their lives behind the bug-eyed screen of a VR headset. Women wear clothes from Brandy Melville, which you can hear described ironically as fashion wear for girls with fascist leanings, and which named one of its lines after John Galt, the hero of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. "People are converting to Catholicism. It's a good thing I have a girlfriend," my friend texted, "because casual sex is out." Yarvin has mused that the liberal regime will begin to fall when the cool kids start to abandon its values and worldview. There are signs that this may be happening, though not all the so-called cool kids involved in this vibe shift would want to be colored as the vanguard in a world historical rebellion against the global order. "I'm not, like, into politics," the writer Honor Levy, a Catholic convert and Bennington grad, told me when I called her. "I just want to have a family someday." Levy, who was a leftist recently enough that she cried when it became clear that Bernie Sanders wouldn't be the Democratic presidential nominee, is friendly with Yarvin and has had him on the podcast she co-host, Wet Brain. "Yeah, the cathedral and blah blah," she said when we got to talking about political media. But she said she'd never even heard of J.D. Vance or Blake Masters. Levy is an it girl in a downtown Manhattan scene. The New Yorker has published her fiction. She is named in a New York Times story that tries to describe that scene, where right-wing politics have become an aesthetic pose that mingles strangely with an earnest search for moral grounding. "Until like a year and a half ago, I didn't believe good and evil existed," she told me, later adding, "but I'm not in a state of grace. I shouldn't be talking." I asked if she would take money from Thiel, and she cheerily said, "Of course." She also described her cohort as a bunch of libertines, and on her podcast, you can get a window into a world of people who enjoy a mind-bendingly ironic thrill by tutting each other for missing church or having premarital sex. "Most of the girls downtown are normal, but they'll wear a Trump hat as an accessory," she said. The ones deep into the online scene, she said, want to be like Leni Riefenstahl, Edie Sedgwick. Like Levy, Milius is in the funny position of being at the intersection of many of these cross currents, having worked in mainstream politics, but appearing on so-called dissident podcasts, and being on the periphery of a cultural scene where right-wing politics have taken on a sheen approximating cool. She said she was too black-pilled, a very online term used to describe people who think that our world is so messed up that nothing can save it now, to think much about what it would look like for her side to win. I could effing trip over the curb, Milius said, and that's going to be considered white supremacism. Like, there's nothing you can do. What the F isn't white supremacism? They're going to come for everything, she said, and I think it's sinister. Not that I think that people who want to pay attention to race issues are sinister, but I think that the globalization movement is using these divisive arguments in order to make people think that it's a good thing. This is the cathedral at work. A few weeks after NatCon, I drove from California to Tucson to meet Masters, a very tall, very thin, very fit 35-year-old. I wanted to see how all this might translate into an actual election campaign, and I'd been watching a lot of Fox News, including Yarvin's streaming interview with Carlson, in which he gave a swirling depiction of how the cathedral produced its groupthink. Why do Yale and Harvard always agree on everything? He asked. These organizations are essentially branches of the same thing, he told a mesmerized Carlson. You're like, where are the wires? He sketched his vision of, as he calls it, a constitutional regime change that would take power back from this oligarchy. So diffuse, most people hardly knew it was there. That's what makes it so hard to kill, he said. At a coffee shop near the house he'd bought when he moved back home to Tucson from the Bay Area, Masters and I went through the tenets of his nationalist platform. Onshoring industrial production, slashing legal immigration, regulating big tech companies, and eventually restructuring the economy so that one salary would be enough to raise a family on. I mentioned Yarvin and his line of arguing that America's system had become so sclerotic that it was hopeless to imagine making big systemic changes like these. In a system where state capacity is very low, I started the question. Alas, he said with a twinkle in his eye. Do we need a crisis to get there? I asked him. Maybe, 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 he said. It wasn't where his immediate thinking was. I'll have the proverbial machete, he said. But yeah, it may take some kind of crisis to get us there. He paused. But we're already sort of in one, right? Masters often says he's not as black-pilled and pessimistic as some in the new right spheres. He seems, unlike many new writers, to still earnestly believe in the power of electoral politics. But he does think that the culturally liberal and free market ideology that has guided America's politics in recent years is a hopeless dead end. A country is not just an economy, Masters told the dissident right outlet IM 1776 recently. You also need a conception of yourself as a nation, as a people, and as a culture. And that's what America is increasingly lacking today. It's true that I'm incredibly hopeful, he said to me. I think it's really bleak. I think the default is continued stagnation. And maybe you get the crisis in 5 years, or maybe it's 30 years from now. He told me that he didn't like to use terms like the cathedral and use the regime less often than Vance, although I later noticed that he used this latter phrase frequently with interviewers on the dissident right. The regime sounds really sexy, right? He said to me. It's a tangible enemy. If you could just grapple with it in the right way, you can topple it. and I think it's actually just a lot less sexy and a lot more bureaucratic, he said. But I've read that stuff, and I see what it means. I asked him about the term teal box, and how true it was that the Teal Foundation was funding a network of new right podcasters and cool kid cultural figures as a sort of cultural vanguard. It depends if it's just dissident right think tank stuff, he told me, or if anyone actually does anything. I don't know how that became a meme, he said, about teal bucks. I think I would know if those kids were getting money. We fund some stuff, he told me, but we're not funding an army of meme posters. He told me that he and Teal had met with Kachian, one of the co-hosts of Red Scare, which was cool, he said. Their podcast is interesting. I asked if there was a world in which they might get funding from Teal. Maybe, yeah, he said. We fund some weird stuff with the Teal Foundation. We drove together to a campaign event, talking about everything from how technology is reshaping our brains to environmental policy, both of us circling from different political directions to an apocalyptic place. I do think we're at a moment of crossroads, he said, and if we play it wrong, it's the Dark Ages. Masters has publicly said he thinks everybody should read the Unabomber's Anti-Tech Manifesto, Industrial Society and Its Future, which may sound strange for a young tech executive running to serve in the United States Senate. But to Masters, Kaczynski's critique was a useful analysis of how technology shapes our world and how degrading and debasing it could be to human lives. I ask whether he thought the core of his project was a fight against a consumerist techno-dystopia that many on the left have also come to fear. He said yes. I ask why, if this was the case, it almost never came across in his mainstream media appearances. That's interesting feedback, he said, that it's not coming through. I go on, and it's the tail end of the B block, and I've got 2 minutes to talk about Kyle Rittenhouse, he'd said earlier, talking about his spots on Fox News. And it's like, well, the left is insane, and this kid shouldn't have been on trial, and they're punishing him for being a white guy who defended himself with an AR-15. Conservative media seems to thrive on culture war touch points as much as all the rest of it. I feel like I'm willing to go there, he said, but you can't do that on Laura Ingraham's soundbites. He was a little less rosy about the future with some interviewers than he was with me. We need someone with their hand on the tiller who understands where we've been and where we need to go, he told the podcaster Alex Kashuta recently. Otherwise, we will get just totally owned by the progressive left. And the progressive left just remains the enemy. It's the enemy of true progress. It's the enemy of everything that is good. I asked if he could give me a vision of what he thought victory for his side would look like. It's just families and meaningful work, he said, so that you can raise your kids and worship and pursue your hobbies and figure out what the meaning of it all is. Pretty much anyone could agree with this, and pretty much anyone could wonder how it is that this sort of thing has come to seem radical or distant from the lives of many people growing into adulthood today. It just feels so networked, he said. It's so in the matrix. We drove a long way into the desert before we arrived at the campaign meet and greet, which was being hosted by a former CIA official in a comfortable retirement community. The crowd of a few dozen was mostly sweater-wearing retirees, immersed in a media culture in which the people who repeated the most incendiary and Trumpist talking points tended to gain attention and political support. This kind of groupthink was not just a phenomenon of the liberal media, and this fact has hampered the campaigns of both Masters and Vance, who are often seen as Trump-aligned culture warriors, and who have had a lot of trouble working their more complicated policy ideas into our fervid political conversation. He talked through his proposal to regulate tech companies as common carriers, like America once regulated phone companies. The crowd seemed interested, but hardly electrified. When he took questions at the end, they were mostly the usual ones about the supposedly stolen 2020 election, a view that Masters did not push back on, the border wall, vaccine mandates. One man raised his hand to ask how Masters planned to drain the swamp. He gave me a sly look. "Well, one of my friends has this acronym he calls RAGE," he said. "Retire all government employees." The crowd liked the sound of this and erupted in a cheer. On the last afternoon of NatCon, a few hours before he was set to give the keynote address, Vance showed up. He spotted me drinking a beer at the bar and came over to say hello. "I still have no idea what I'm going to say," he said, though he didn't seem worried. I wandered down to the ballroom to wait and ended up sitting with a U.S. correspondent for the German news magazine Der Spiegel. I knew that some of the reporters there might have been under the impression that this was all mostly just Tweety MAGA pageantry. He had a more complex view, having just spoken to Yarvin, and asked me to explain his philosophy. I found myself at a loss. I said that there were these things called the regime and the cathedral, and that Yarvin was sort of a monarchist. "A monarchist?" he asked. He seemed taken aback to learn that what this hero figure of the new right dreamed of was a king. Vance showed up wearing a suit and bright red tie, looking relaxed for a person who was about to give a speech to hundreds of people who viewed him as possibly a last great hope in saving the American nation from global corporatist subjugation. He'd shot up in the polls, and at that moment was second in his primary, helped by regular invitations from Carlson. I asked how he was feeling about the speech. He looked impish. "I think I've got a good topic," he said. "I'm going to talk about college." What he meant was that he was about to give a genuinely thunderous speech titled, "The Universities Are the Enemy." People immediately pointed out that it was a variation on something that Richard Nixon said to Henry Kissinger on White House tapes back in 1972. Vance denounced elite colleges as enemies of the American people. He has long proposed cutting off their federal funding and seizing their endowments. The speech was later linked in alarmed op-eds to anti-intellectual movements that had attacked institutions of learning. But that doesn't quite reckon with what an apocalyptic message he was offering, because Vance and this new right cohort, who are mostly so highly educated and well-read that their big problem often seems to be that they're just too nerdy to be an effective force in mass politics, are not anti-intellectual. Vance is an intellectual himself, even if he's not currently playing one on TV. But he thinks that our universities are full of people who have a structural, self-serving, and financial interest in coloring American culture as racist and evil. And he is ready to go to extraordinary lengths to fight them. Yarvin and Lawrenson bounded out of the crowd as the cheers were still ringing. They were giggling, seeming to have had some wine. "Nixon! Nixon!" Lawrenson said, still laughing. I couldn't tell if she was delighted or horrified. A couple of hours later, I found Vance standing up by the bar, surrounded by a circle of young and identical-looking fanboys. I went over. He asked what I'd thought of the speech, and he suggested we find somewhere to talk. He asked me to turn my recorder off so we could speak candidly. I agreed, with regret, because the conversation revealed someone who I think will be hugely influential in our politics in the coming years, even if he loses his Senate primary, as both of us thought was possible. It also revealed someone who was in a dark place, with a view that we are at an ominous turning point in America's history. He didn't want to describe this to me on the record, but I can show it anyway, because he already says it publicly, and you can hear it too. That night, I went up to my hotel room and listened to a podcast interview Vance had conducted with Jack Murphy, the big bearded head of the Liminal Order men's group. Murphy asked how it was that Vance proposed to rip out America's leadership class. Vance described two possibilities that many on the new right imagine, that our system will either fall apart naturally or that a great leader will assume semi-dictatorial powers. So there's this guy, Curtis Yarvin, who has written about some of these things, Vance said. Murphy chortled knowingly. So one option is to basically accept that this entire thing is going to fall in on itself, Vance went on. And so the task of conservatives right now is to preserve as much as can be preserved, waiting for the inevitable collapse of the current order. He said he thought this was pessimistic. I tend to think that we should seize the institutions of the left, he said, and turn them against the left. We need like a de-bathification program, a de-wokification program. I think Trump is going to run again in 2024, he said. I think that what Trump should do, if I was giving him one piece of advice, fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state, replace them with our people. And when the courts stop you, he went on, stand before the country and say, he quoted Andrew Jackson, giving a challenge to the entire constitutional order, the Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it. This is a description, essentially, of a coup. We are in a late Republican period, Vance said later, evoking the common new right view of America as Rome, awaiting its Caesar. If we're going to push back against it, we're going to have to get pretty wild and pretty far out there and go in directions that a lot of conservatives right now are uncomfortable with. Indeed, Murphy said, among some of my circle, the phrase extra-constitutional has come up quite a bit. I'd ask Vance to tell me, on the record, what he'd like liberal Americans who thought that what he was proposing was a fascist takeover of America to understand. He spoke earnestly. I think the cultural world you operate in is incredibly biased, he said, against his movement, and the leaders of it, like me in particular. He encouraged me to resist this tendency, which he thought was the product of a media machine leading us toward a soulless dystopia that none of us want to live in. That impulse, he said, is fundamentally in service of something that is far worse than anything in your wildest nightmares than what you see here. He gave me an imploring look, as though to suggest that he was more on the side of the kind of people who read Vanity Fair than most of you realize. If what he was doing worked, he said, it will mean that my son grows up in a world where his masculinity, his support of his family and his community, his love of his community, is more important than whether it works for effing McKenzie. At that, we called it, and the crowd of young men who wanted to talk to him immediately descended on the couches. People kept bringing drinks, and there was a lot of shit talk, and it went on late. I remember thinking at one point how strange it was that in our mid-30s, Vance and I were significantly older than almost everyone there, all of whom thought they were organizing a struggle to change the course of human history, and all of whom were now going to get sloppy drunk. The next morning, wrecked, I put on sweatpants and a hoodie and tried to smuggle myself out of the hotel without having to talk to anyone. I gave my chit to the valet and looked around to find Vance and Yarvin standing there waiting for cars. How do you guys feel? Yarvin asked. Vance was wearing a hoodie, too, and looked like I felt. I feel horrible, he said. Not good. Yarvin asked what I thought of everything. I said it would take a long time for me to figure that out. We all shook hands, and they waved as I got into my car, and we all resumed our usual battle stations in the American Info Wars. Modern folklore. Country music's new stars are not aw shucks down on their luck cowboys, but young black women, carving a hallowed space in Opry's pantheon, and they've got the lyrics, the sound, and the looks to last. By Tressie McMillan Cottom, with photographs by Miranda Barnes. Sittings editor, Nicole Chapoteau. Opening photos, Amethyst Kia. Album, Wary. Plus Strange. Liner notes, an alum of East Tennessee State University's Bluegrass, Old Time, and Roots Music Studies program, Kia already has a Grammy nomination for pinning Black Myself in 2020. Adia Victoria, album A Southern Gothic, liner notes. As the title of her latest album suggests, the South Carolina native's sonic creations are imbued with the deep hues of Gothic indie blues, tales of life that both unsettle and intrigue listeners. 10 years ago, you could not name more than three Black country music artists, if you could name any country artist at all. In 2022, there are so many Black artists making contemporary country music, you would have to book a festival to get even half of them on one show bill. And if you did book that festival, it would feature a lot of Black women. Respect to the brothers, like classic man Darius Rucker and young blood Jimmy Allen, but the Black country women are serving. What you want, they got it. Love songs, girl power anthems, grooves, protest music. And they do not just serve bops. They also serve looks. They are sexy, cool, and irreverent. Grounded in multiple musical traditions, each has a unique sound, but all of them pay homage to the Black music dynasty. In the 1940s, Sister Rosetta Tharpe strutted onto stages with a guitar strapped around her neck and helped invent rock and roll. Starting in the late 1960s, soul funk psychedelic pioneer Betty Davis, may she rest in funk, survived Miles Davis and made anthems for weird Black girls who didn't want to marry a genre. Rock, gospel, blues, roots, folk, a little Stax, a little Motown, a little Philly, and a little Mississippi Delta. Joy Eladokun, Alison Russell, Adia Victoria, Amethyst Kia, and Brittany Spencer have bits of it all in their songwriting and stagecraft. Their secret sauce is as old as human migration. These women have soul. Black female artist reimagining country music is a revival of sorts, and it is not happening in a vacuum. R&B music is also finding its footing in pop music again after being reduced to hip-hop hooks and adult contemporary radio. The R&B revival also owes a lot to women artists. Her, Ella Mai, Summer Walker, and Ari Lennox have successfully cut through the hip-hop dance music domination. Social media platforms like TikTok play a significant role in getting the jams out to the people, but that only works because the music has, as Her described it in a 2018 interview with Gary T. Kennedy, real, genuine emotions that people want and need, especially now. Critically, for a writer, Joy, Allison, Adia, Amethyst, and Brittany are in the part of the celebrity cycle where they are still interesting, still talk like humans. When I sat down with them over the course of a week in Nashville, which I essayed about elsewhere at the time, they were open, real, and above all, ready. Now they are gracing the pages of Vanity Fair as emerging icons of country soul's musical dynasty. It is 2022, and mainstream country music has not yet figured out how to fit these singer-songwriters into traditional platforms. Like independent and minority artists before them, they have much better success with live shows, satellite radio, and streaming platforms. And their ride is far from over. They are touring, releasing new music, getting corporate sponsorships, and being name-checked by musical heroes like Brandi Carlile, Jason Isbell, Maren Morris, and Rhiannon Giddens. Individually and collectively, these artists are poised to write a new chapter in Black music's enduring legacy. Well-meaning people have asked them a million times about race and equity and diversity in country music. I don't want to be well-meaning. I want to mean them well. These are artists with perspectives on the world. As artists who have the entire legacy of Black music at their disposal, I want to talk about how they choose to make their art and what it means to be making it in surprising ways. Their answers varied, but all spoke of a musical tapestry that saved them in some way. As good keepers of the legacy they inherited, they are simply paying it forward. The sense of coming into one's own is especially true for Alison Russell, who made one of the best albums of 2021. Fight with somebody else about this. Outside Child is otherworldly. Variety called it beautiful, harrowing. It was nominated for Best Americana Album at the 2022 Grammys. The album's standout track is Night Flyer, which lives inside of you, moving between traditional roots instrumentation. At one point, in the live version, she plays the clarinet, and the kind of jazz vocalization that scandalized audiences in the early 20th century. Her delivery reminds you that jazz was not always easy listening. It used to be dangerous. Jazz was once considered a sexual vice, bound to lead to race mixing and civil rot. Henry Ford was so incensed by jazz's popularity that he spent money to train America's youth to square dance instead. Biracial, sexy, and jazzy, I like to imagine Russell's music playing as Ford drove himself over a metaphorical cliff. Next photo, Alison Russell. Album, Outside Child. Liner notes, ever the collaborator, Russell's debut solo project delves into her long-held fascination with fables, historic myths, and lullabies, many of which she was exposed to by her Scottish-Canadian grandmother. If Russell's fierceness is not evident, it is because people often underestimate beautiful women. Sitting across the screen from Russell, 42, I know a survivor when I see one. Hers is a story of slightly different flavor than those who usually make black music. She's Canadian, for one. I didn't grow up in black culture at all, she says plainly. That her journey brought her to the same place as generations of soul women before her speaks volumes about the universality of black creative genius. Far from the clay dirt roads that made black music, Russell was part of a white Canadian family that rejected her blackness. Her mother married an adoptive father that Russell describes as a white supremacist. You know, I was in the belly of this horrific colonial beast, she told me, scarred but unbowed by the time she owned the 2021 Newport Folk Festival stage. It was clear that Russell had found her way home. To get there, she had to go south. Next photo, Joy Oladokun. Album, In Defense of My Own Happiness. Liner notes, inspired to first pick up a guitar after seeing a video of Tracy Chapman. The songwriter and self-proclaimed sensitive stoner writes music focused squarely on life as she learns to live it. Russell's journey to roots music through racial geography was, she says, part of what saved her life. Coming to the South has been like, holy shit, I'm not alone. There's mixed heritage black folks like me everywhere. In roots music, Russell found a musical dynasty that matched the depth of the trauma that growing up in an abusive household visited upon her. It was the legacy of black joy and pain, that melding of the sacred and the profane, so integral to the black diasporic experience, that helped her find her voice. Joy Olodikun does not care what you call her music, just don't come calling her all the time. She is busy up on her mountain, playing with chickens, blazing for a little relaxation, and making music in her home studio. Smooth as triple distilled whiskey, everything about Olodikun is a vibe. Her 2020 album, In Defense of My Own Happiness, The Beginnings, has earned her a lot of love. In 2021, when she was nominated for the Americana Music Honors and Awards Emerging Act of the Year, and this year, as she's up for the GLAAD Media Awards Outstanding Breakthrough Music Artist. Her music has been featured on some of the biggest television series of the last few years, most recently the Sex and the City reboot, and Just Like That. Olodokun, 30, is the youngest of this cohort. Her name is both prescient and redundant. She oozes energy that shifts a room's center of gravity and makes you happy for it. It is charisma, and she has it in spades. It's the way she approaches her craft, too. The story and the emotion are first, she tells me. I want people to feel like they're sitting across the table from me, talking about the past few months, or talking about that breakup, the emotion, the thought, the conclusion. Not a lot of fuss. Last fall, as COVID was roaring back, I posted Olodokun's look up on social media. People went nuts. There is something about her delivery, for sure. Her voice is honeyed, lilting like teacups at Disneyland. It is a new age gospel song. No big riffs or exhaustive runs. No drum machines. But the heart of soul is there. Someone tweets at me that they have been in tears listening to it. It could be a Negro spiritual for how I am crying, they say. Like Russell, Olodokun came by her musical inheritance through a circuitous route. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.